This podcast is brought to you by Workle, a platform helping people get happier at work. Find out more at workle.co. Work happier.
It's been wild. We launched our first experiment into space a month ago. I knew that I wanted to do something that used my brain and that challenged my brain. I want to work in the space industry, building life science experiments for space. No one has done this before.
Welcome to the Happy Work Life podcast, where people with inspiring careers reflect on how happy they have been in their working lives. On this podcast, we hear from a range of people working in business, startups, science, academia, media, healthcare, fashion, and much more, and find out which roles gave them the most satisfaction and, importantly, what they have done to get happier at work. So, sit down with me, Mark Price, founder of Workle, to help you get happier at work. Workle is the platform where you can find a job in the happiest companies, take our happiness test, network, and get career support from experts, and much, much more. On this edition of the Happy Work Life podcast, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Katie King. Katie is the CEO and co-founder of BioOrbit, a company building a pharmaceutical factory in microgravity to revolutionise cancer treatments. Katie studied science at school and at university. She did a PhD in nanomedicine at the University of Cambridge. She's worked at NASA for AstraZeneca, and if that's not enough, she's an RAF volunteer reservist. She's also been nominated for numerous awards, including Innovator of the Year Award in 2024. Katie is trying to do something that nobody else has done before, to build a company that will manufacture drugs in space to make them more effective so that more people around the world can have cancer treatments at home rather than going for invasive treatments in hospitals. Katie, it's lovely to have you on the podcast. I'm really excited to talk to you about your career and founding BioOrbit and all you want to do there. But before we get on to that, I really want to go back to your early years and to try and understand what took you into the world of medicine and science and AstraZeneca and NASA. So tell us what you were like when you were at school.
Yeah, sure. I mean, thank you very much for having me on today. So I'd say at school, I always loved working. I loved maths and science. I think the thing that got me into science and maths was just a love of space and a dream to want to be an astronaut. And then thinking, well, how do I get there? I have to do science. I have to be a scientist. So I have to work hard at these subjects. So I always enjoyed problem solving. Maths, would do maths in my spare time because that is the sort of person I was. Just really enjoyed doing that. And then decided when I was about 12 or 13 that I really wanted to do science at a brilliant university. Not really sure what university was, because I don't think you don't understand what that is when you're 11 or 12, but I knew that, okay, that's kind of what I want to do. So worked hard all through school to try and get there. And I would say, though, that I always, as a child, it wasn't like things necessarily came very naturally to me. I would really push and work to get better at something. So if I struggled with a particular area of maths or a particular area of science, I just wouldn't give up and would just like keep like pushing really hard until I got there.
And there's lots of debate in the country moment about the importance of STEM and wanting more people to go in, but also that girls at schools seem to be less interested, or there seem to be fewer girls going into STEM subjects. Yeah. Why do you think that is? And what do you think could change that, Katie?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question. It's a big problem. Things are definitely changing. I think it's a very multifaceted problem. There's not like one solution to it. I do think that it's so important to see, like they say, you know, you can't be be what you can't see. And if you see someone who you relate to doing it, it's like, oh, well, if they can do it, I can do it. And you can see yourself in their position. I think that counts for a lot. I also think that when you're at school, your environment very much is family, friends, and your teachers. That's really your whole world. And so as a parent or a teacher, you have to be really careful with sort of certain language that's being used, because saying things like, oh, maths, oh, that's a really hard subject, are you sure you want to do that, sort of implies that if something's difficult, then that child or that daughter or niece or anything isn't capable of doing it. So it's like changing the language and being aware of the implicit messages that could come through. And because you do take that on board and absorb it as a kid. But I do think when you have someone who believes in you, whether that's a teacher or a family member or anything, that counts for so much. I remember having one physics teacher who believed in me. And if I was struggling with something, and they said, no, Katie, like, you can do this. You can do this. I know you can. And then I was just like, okay, I can. I don't think I can, but you think I can. So, okay. And those small things can be really pivotal in, like, for a child's and a human's upbringing, everything.
And would you credit that physics teacher then with being kind of instrumental in terms of you wanting to move into science and sciences?
For sure. I'd say I knew at GCSEs that this is what I wanted to do, but I didn't notice the gender like ratio being off until A levels, when I was like one of, if not the only girl in all of my classes. And I remember, and that was that physics teacher then, because I remember thinking, why, where are all the girls? Like I didn't understand. And so then, so if the class was getting rowdy or the lads were misbehaving or anything, then I remember that physics teacher just being like, it's okay, like, Katie, don't worry, just focus and it'll be okay. but because he believed in me and brought me in to do like, they had a physics and like an extra physics, tricky physics club. And so I became part of that. So he was really instrumental in how it changed me seeing my own ability. So I never thought I was particularly capable, but he was made me see that my brain could do difficult problems, could solve difficult problems.
And so at that point, Katie, had you decided what you wanted to do for work? So you've done really well in GCSEs and you picked your A levels. Did you know then what you wanted to do?
Not at all. I don't think it's not a straight line at all. I knew that I wanted to do something that used my brain and that challenged my brain, because I get a lot of joy when you crack a hard problem. It's like I get a dopamine hit. And so I knew I wanted to do something in the sciences that engaged my brain, but in terms of a career, absolutely clueless. But I still had the dream of wanting to be an astronaut, because it combines so much of like everything that I enjoy: problem solving, teamwork, expedition. You have to have a high trust amongst the team members as well. And so it just captured so many things that I love.
Can you remember the first time that you thought that you wanted to be an astronaut?
I actually can, yeah. It was going to the IMAX. It was a school trip, going to the IMAX and watching Space Station in 3D. And I remember watching this and seeing an astronaut playing with water, and this water was just floating around in the space station, and he was playing with it. And I just thought very simply, like, wow, that looks really cool. I want to see that. And that was it. I was like, okay, so if you want to see that, you're going to have to become an astronaut and get to space.
And did that, because I know that you're an RAF reservist. When did you decide to do that?
So that was during school. I did sort of cadets basically, and then during university, then went into the RAF stream, and that was more A levels into university, and again, it I loved that. That was also linked in with my dream as well of going into space and being part of that, like the camaraderie in the cadets, etc., is very similar to a camaraderie between an astronaut corps and an astronaut team. So it's the parallels are very much there. So I learned a lot there, not just like practically learned a lot, but in terms of leading a team, and how valuable and critical team morale is for when you're going through difficult times, and how powerful interpersonal connections can be, both in the positive and the negative. So I feel like that exposed me to a lot of those learnings.
And would you recommend to people listening to the podcast going into the cadets, RAF cadet?
I mean, I think as a kid as well, it's such a fantastic opportunity because you're there with lots of other kids around about your age from different schools and all sorts, and you can learn a lot about like self-discipline and working with other teammates and learning how to communicate in team tasks. I think you learn a lot through going through that. So I would always recommend it, and it's great because you feel like you belong somewhere, and I think that that's a really special thing to have when you're a child as well. It's like this is my club, as it were.
So I think we've got a pretty good feel for you now. When you were younger, you liked sciences, you were good at maths, you had a physics teacher who was pretty instrumental in driving you down the science route. You wanted to go to space and be an astronaut, and you joined the RAF as a cadet. So let's move on a few years now in university. So what did you decide to do at university?
Yes. So at university, it was a mixed course, so lots of different science subjects within the same course. So I did physics, chemistry, and material science at the beginning. And then there was an option to do neuroscience as well. And I hadn't done biology since GCSE, but I was always fascinated by the brain and why we think as we do and consciousness and all sorts. So I decided to take that as well. And I remember my professors being like, why? This is a really unusual combination. And I just thought, well, I'm never going to get the chance to learn about this again. And I'd love to get taught by some of the experts in the whole field. And even if I don't do well in the exam, I still want to learn. So anyway, did that. And then specialized in chemistry towards the end of the degree. And I just loved that you can control molecules on the molecular level, and that can have a macro scale effect as to how the material behaves through controlling on this on the tiny scale, basically.
And did you enjoy your degree?
I did. I think that it was very intense, and the workload was very heavy and high. And a lot was expected of you, but I enjoy intensity like that, so it suited me well. I did get very sick towards the end of every term because you just can't keep up that degree of intensity for a long time. It's not sustainable. But I did enjoy it, but it definitely made me very sick.
And then at the end of university, I mean, you did a PhD, which obviously we'll talk about. But what was your thinking towards the end of your university years in terms of where you were thinking in terms of work?
I'd say at that point I was still quite clueless. I didn't feel like I'd fi finished with science. I d didn't know immediately if I wanted to do a PhD. I felt like I wanted to give back to science rather than just learning what other people have found out. I wanted to take that and then push something a little bit further, to find out something new. But I still wasn't sure at all. But I didn't really want to go and work in the city. I still wanted to be in the lab and do some science. Started a PhD at Imperial first, looking at neurotechnology. So this was again my interest in the brain and how you can create something that can read the status of some neurons and like understand what's going on inside without the neurons realizing that they're being read, basically. So it was so interesting, but the whole setup and life at the time, it wasn't the right thing for me. And so then I actually became a teacher for a while. So I went back to school the other side of the teacher's desk and taught maths and physics through secondary school. And that was wonderful and was so fulfilling. And yeah, that was one of the best things I've ever done. And it was during that time that then I got a call from Cambridge to say, we've got some funding for a PhD we think you'd be great for. Would you consider coming back for this PhD? And which I did end up taking that in the end. But that middle period between my master's, actually, I should say, I spent a time at NASA at that point before starting this neurotechnology PhD. So it was all a little bit of a squiggle and a mess during those few years before I ended up going back to Cambridge for the PhD.
And just a few words on your PhD. What was your PhD?
Yes, so my PhD was building it was nanomedicine, so building nanoparticle drug delivery systems. So this is through controlling the atoms and building gold nanoparticles. What you decorate the outside with can help you to target certain cancer cells to effectively deliver the drug into the unhealthy cells and avoid the attacking the healthy cells to minimize side effects.
Let's just wind back a little then. So we know you've done your degree. You've done spent some time in teaching, which you really loved. You then got the chance to go and do the PhD, and that had a link to, as you've just said, cancer and cancer treatments. But then before that, NASA. So how did you get
Yes.
involved with the NASA?
Yes. So again, I wasn't really sure after my master's, like, okay, where am I going? What am I doing? But I had my love for space and said, okay, well, let's see, is there anything, can I do anything here? And NASA have a summer internship program where they take in hundreds of interns in various departments around their sites. And they did have some spots for international students rather than just American students. So it was a different application to the American students. And yeah, there were, I can't remember how many places, not too many. And so I applied to that and got a position as a international intern to go over there for 9 weeks. And I was working in the what was called the Sample Analysis at Mars team. So there's a rover on Mars called Curiosity. And within Curiosity, there's an experiment that's looking to see if there are any remnants of organic matter stuck in the rock, which will either show whether Mars once held life, had life on Mars, or whether the rock is capable of preserving life and therefore could Mars accommodate life in the future. So, yeah, that was a very exciting 9 weeks.
So having done that, did that just sort of reinforce your desire to be an astronaut to do work in space?
Yeah, I'd say one thing I felt very lucky to have seen there was this was the time when the photos of Pluto came back through. So this was again just about 10 years ago now. And so the team, all the planetary teams are in the same building, which I always thought was quite funny. So in the canteen coffee bit on the bottom floor, all of the like Pluto team were there celebrating these images coming back. And it was beautiful to see because this team had been working on it for decades and had to wait 10, maybe 20 years before the data came back. And here they were celebrating the fruits of their work decades ago. And I was so inspired by that because, you know, they had lost team members along the way. And this is the thing with space, it's an intergenerational effort, and you might not see the fruits of your own work, but it's about pushing it forward and passing the baton on to the next generation so then they can push it forward even further than you could. And I felt very inspired by that and thought it really made me think I want to be a part of this bigger mission in using space. And discovering space and using space for Earth and just play my little role in that.
When you had finished that and you'd finished your PhD in nanomedicine, what did you decide to do then?
So I decided during my PhD that I really want to work in the space sector. So SpaceX at this point was starting to change the game. Reusability was demonstrated. And I thought, right, I want to work in the space industry building life science experiments for space. Because I very much believe that this is where a lot of use case is going to come from. And with the commercialization of space, I was like, okay, well, life sciences and health is going to be a big winner here. So I spoke with some recruiters and was like, hi, I'm Katie. I'd like to build life science experiments in space. Can you link me up with companies doing this? And they said, Katie, those jobs don't exist. That's not a thing. And I said, what do you mean it's not a thing? I couldn't understand that. I was like, okay. And so I was a bit like, okay, well, now what? So started looking at all sorts of space companies, but I'm not an engineer, and all of the jobs were for engineers. I thought, oh, this sucks. Basically, this really sucks. And then in the summer, I went to a professional, what I call it, think of it like professional space camp. It was the International Space University, and they have a summer program. And I went on this program. And was still there, like, okay, I want to find a job in the space industry. And it was there really that the idea of bioorbit started. So this is the summer of 22. So I never like planned to be a founder or anything like that. But the idea came in, myself and a team, looking for areas of microgravity research that could impact humanity in the most positive way and have a good business case. And it was the idea came then, but it wasn't until a few months later that a smaller group of us were like, we need to push this forward. And then by this point, I had a job at a space company. And then I decided to quit and in May of 2023 and was like, someone has to be full time. I'm going to take the jump. I'm going to push this. And yes, had some savings. So it's like, okay, I've got about a year's worth of savings. So by the end of the 12 months, we'll either have investment and I'll have a job or I'll have to find a job elsewhere. So like, let's go. So that's kind of how it happened. And yeah, took the jump 2 years ago now.
And before I ask you about setting up a company and what's that like and what's the great thing, what are the really challenging things, just a bit on why you believe that microgravity is so important to push the frontiers of medicine.
Yes. So there's been a lot of research on the ISS over the past few decades and looking at how a microgravity environment affects certain phenomena, affects life, affects medicine, materials, and all sorts. And one of the a huge finding was in how in a microgravity environment, the process of crystallization is far superior than it is here on Earth. And that's because gravity causes problems in a crystallization process. And when you apply that to drugs and you crystallize drugs, you can form new structures and new products that you cannot form here on Earth. So what that means in like real money is that you can take a drug that typically you have to inject intravenously, and you can turn it into a drug that can be self-injected. So through crystallization. So what we are building is hardware to mass produce these crystals so that patients don't need to go to hospital anymore. They don't need to get intravenous cancer treatment, but it can be turned into a pen like diabetics inject with insulin and they can treat themselves at home. And these crystals allow that switch to happen.
And your ambition for BioOrbit is for it to be the biggest manufacturer and research center in microgravity.
Yes, that is the dream. That is the vision, is for us to have our own permanent facilities in space. And then later down the line, I would love for us to have our own astronaut corps of scientists going up and doing research up there.
I mean, that's quite a dream. That's quite an ambition.
It is, but you have to dream big and then you make it into lots of smaller steps to get there. That's the only way that you can achieve something impossible. is just break it down and go as far. Go keep just keep plodding. You'll get there eventually.
And what I'm sure our listeners have now got to is how all the various bits of what you did have brought you to this place, seeing the opportunity because nobody else was doing it, your time at NASA, AstraZeneca, your PhD, your love of maths and science. So it's an incredible journey, isn't it, that's brought all of those elements together that have then crystallized in what you've founded and are doing now.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's one of those things whenever you look back, it all for anybody looking back at a journey, it's like, oh, it all makes sense. But at the time, nothing made sense because there was no clear direction or clear path. I didn't really know what a startup was. I didn't know what founding a company, I didn't know what that even meant. So it was a steep learning curve. But again, you just, I think it's like looking and seeing opportunities and then going for it. Yes, my background maybe like helped me to be able to see an opportunity. But yes, I'd say it was a very squiggly path for a long time.
And so that professor at Cambridge who said to you at the beginning, why are you doing neuroscience along with physics, is probably now saying what absolute genius it was, Katie.
Oh, I don't know about that, but it's definitely like learning a lot about different areas of science. You can then start to see that how they all overlap and interlink because it's all the same stuff. It's just the natural world. You can't really split it into different sections too well. They all affect each other. So yes, but that's just my belief.
And then a lot of people listening to our podcast often think about setting up their own business and founding things. You've explained sort of part of it, actually having the idea. Nobody else was doing this, and I thought it was a good idea. So that's the first step. The second step is, I'm actually really going to do this. I'm going to give up my job. I'm going to da-da. So you've explained that. But talk to us about setting up a company. What was relatively straightforward, and what have you found more challenging?
Yeah, I'd say again, it was a very steep learning curve. Setting it up, like legally setting it up, is quite a simple process on Companies House. But again, I think thinking about things like trademarks and what are you going to call it and what. Getting the legal processes to sort all of that was quite a steep learning curve. And understanding what documents you have to be responsible for, again, just if you've never had exposure to it, it's not obvious. You do need someone to explain it to you. And then like, ah, okay, understood. I'd say that that was one bit, but you can learn that quite quickly. The aspects that were harder. How do you get money to fund such an idea? How can you actually start moving it off the ground? And that is, it's not a given. So, I had to learn what fundraising was, how do funding rounds work, what's a good deal, what's a bad deal, how you can, what's normal. Had to learn that all very quickly. Accelerator programs were very good for that, and they can teach you some of those basics. And then, and that allows you to move up a level. And then you just have to, I'd say, you have to just learn very fast and adapt very quickly as you're learning new information. But it was getting exposure to investors that was a difficult step. How do you get in front of these people? Having a pitch deck that and making sure that your pitch deck is good. I cannot stress how important a pitch deck is, which at first I thought was ridiculous because it's a PowerPoint presentation. It's just a PowerPoint presentation, but it's all about how well you can communicate the value of what you're doing and how succinctly you can say it and clearly and in a compelling manner, because they're not just looking at what you're saying, but how you're saying it, because they need to know that you are capable of, in time, raising tens of millions, hundreds of millions of pounds, and that you can convince people and bring them on that journey with you. So it's a whole, it was a steep learning curve with that, and I got a lot of critique and feedback that basically ripped me to shreds, and then you build back up again. I'd say that's it, critical.
And then tell us about how the journey's going.
Yeah, it's been wild. It is, we've hired first people not even a year ago now, and we launched our first experiment into space a month ago, and have another one coming up later next year. And so we're now a team of 8 to 10 people, different, like 8 full time and then 10 including part time. And yes, it's been incredible building the team, finding some offices, having actual space. How do you work out where you want to be, how you hire people, what makes a team, like bringing a team close together, building processes from the beginning because we don't have any processes, and so we've had to build that as we grow. And there are a lot of growing pains as you're going from a team of a few people to a team of 10 and an actual company. It's very different. So a lot of growing pains with that, but it's been so exciting, and I've felt so proud of the team pushing as hard as they are pushing for these launches because we are doing something difficult. No one has done this before, but we have absolute belief that we can do this, and we want the world to see the benefits that space can bring. And we want patients to stay at home and treat themselves, and it's like really being mission focused. It gets you through the inevitable hard times, of which there are lots. That's just the nature of it. But we really believe that we're onto something big here.
Fantastic. And let me ask you an impossible question.
Sure.
10 years from now, what's your dream, hope, and ambition for BioOrbit?
10 years from now, I would hope that we have some permanent facilities in space. I don't think we'll quite have our own space station yet, but I think we'll have some of our manufacturing lines in space. And I would hope that we'd have multiple drugs that we're working on making them in space. So I'd hope that we'd be very big in this country, probably international, well, definitely international by 10 years' time. And that, that patients are being injected with the crystals that we have grown in space.
And Katie, in conclusion, what makes you happy in your work?
The team. Nothing brings me more joy than seeing my team working well together. It's really special. And so building that team where people feel valued and critical and happy to be around each other brings me the most joy. And then
That's
working towards a purpose is a big one, but seeing that team pushing towards it, huge.
Brilliant. Well, I'm sure everybody listening to this podcast wish you every success. I mean, what you're doing is simply amazing. You're breaking new frontiers. You're creating a product which will help literally millions of people and make their lives much easier in their cancer treatments. And it's just such an amazing, compelling story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you very much for having me, and really enjoy speaking. Thank you.
To listen to more episodes and find out how to get happy in your working life, head to workall.co. Work happier.